You ever notice how strange it feels when life slows down after getting out of the military? You get a job, maybe a family. Things look fine on the outside, but something still feels off, like you're not totally sure who you are without the uniform. That's where today's guest, Timothy Wynecki, comes in. He's an Air Force veteran who now works as a counselor, helping other veterans make sense of that in-between space, the stuff that nobody really prepares you for when you get out. We're going to talk about what masculinity actually means, why connection matters more than we think, and how to start feeling like yourself again. Before we get started, though, I want to take a second to highlight the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. They're building a permanent memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor those who served, supported, and sacrificed during the Global War on Terrorism. To learn more about this memorial or to get involved, visit GWATMemorialFoundation.org. Now let's get into today's episode. Hey, Timothy, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, bud.
Yeah, no problem. Hey, before we kind of get into, you know, kind of everything we're going to talk about today, can you give the listeners just a little bit of background on who you are and kind of what got you into doing what you're doing today and sure. Kind of military background, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so I think service has been important to me my whole life. My therapist pointed this out when we were talking about it and kind of stuck with me. I started in student government in third grade and continued all the way through college. And so it's always been important and been very people motivated, right? So did college, came out of college during the economic crash in 05 and couldn't get any traction. Denver was one of the first cities hit. And so I started looking at the military as a viable option. By then I had a few buddies that had gone in and some of them were getting out, some staying in, and got the advice to go enlisted into the Air Force, picking a job instead of going officer in the Army or Navy, not picking the job. Still think that was really good advice, right? So I went in at 27. I barely made the line for the cutoff for going in. So I was everybody's uncle, right? Old man wanky back then, if you can imagine.
Yeah, no, I can. I actually was on the older side too when I went in. I think I was 24. So, you know, I wasn't quite 27, but I was up there. There, I think there was like one or two guys that were older than me in my basic training.
Yeah, the only guys that were as old as me were guys coming into the guard.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So like the Air Force saved my life though. Before I was going in, man, I was working crap temp jobs. I couldn't get any traction on anything. Couldn't even afford a new pair of shoes. Shoes had holes in them. Air Force saved my life, man. A lot of people have a lot of complicated relationships with their service, and I have mine as like anybody, but I'll always be thankful for that. And so I went in as an intelligence analyst, which is super boring. Anybody who's ever worked it can tell you that secret is not always interesting, it turns out. But it did give me some really wonderful opportunities. I got to go to Korea, stationed at Osan for a year. Then I got to go to England for 2 years before buying a personalist a lot of beer to get back to Colorado for my last year in. And through that time, I found that I was a decent operator, but I wasn't going to be a good one. Mm-hmm. Right? To do like the code stuff, you really have to have a little sprinkle of autism to be really, really good at it. And that's not a drag on autistic people. Like it's a useful thing to have in that
sure.
environment, right? But I'm people focused, so I could do it. I was smart enough to do it. Hated it. Mm-hmm. So naturally, I did all of the Air Force stuff, right? I really liked being an airman. I liked taking care of people. And so in Osan is where I started volunteering as a sexual assault response volunteer. So if you're in the Army, it's like a sapper, I think is what y'all used to call it. I don't know what they call it now.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure what it is, yeah.
And that was great. Osan at the time had the largest problem of sexual assault in all of the Air Force because it's a perpetrator's dream, right? It's first term airman, everybody's drunk. It's bet. If you're a bad guy, it's where you want to be. And so I got lucky though. I went to England and I was at a small base there. And so I was one of the only people doing that work there. And then the Air Force got in trouble. This was back in like 2010. And so I think this is when the Academy had its big hoopla around the ring, and we got two drill instructors that had been assaulting trainees. And so we made national news. And the military always loves making national news for these things, right? But they ended up launching the bystander intervention program, which was great. Basically, they went from doing slides around, hey, did you know that rape was bad? Maybe don't be a dick. and don't rape or we're going to get you in trouble. Those slides do great things. Like everybody already knows that.
Right.
And they went instead on, hey, sexual assault is a violent crime. 70% of all violent crime are witnessed at some point. If you witness something, why should you care and what should you do? And so the joke is I got to spend 2 years training over 3,000 airmen, 15 guys at a time to punch rapists. Great job. Favorite job I've ever had. But it was during the training for that, that the PhD, well, like there were three PhD that designed it. And since I was in the English theater, like they came out and did the training, which was great. And one of them pulled me out for a lunch and was like, hey, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I do intelligence work. You're doing the wrong thing. You should be doing this kind of work. You should look at that. And that was the nudge I needed to move into more clinical work.
Okay.
And so I got out of the Air Force. I was 32. I kind of had my like 6 month like transition on a couch trying to figure it out and then sorted out getting into a graduate program for counseling. It was a great time. I got my teeth kicked in pretty well, which needed. It was a big, big transition from going from direct military speak to a bunch of counselors talking nice to each other. And while I was in grad school, I continued to do the interpersonal violence work, did some trainings, worked crisis lines. But the thing I'm proudest of during that time is I built out Colorado's most successful veteran transition program that we had. So PAVE was a national program. We were one of their pilot schools, and we took a program that had two people that were like work studies on a college campus that would help whoever came in that they could catch, to every single veteran that signed up for classes getting an orientation and a mentor. And that really changed things for a lot of guys. It was a really good time. From there, I went back to doing clinical work, launched a veterans program. It went okay. And then started up my practice because I got tired of having bosses between the military and college campuses. And it's not that people are dumb, but at least my mistakes I can clean up.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I definitely get it. And I think a lot of folks who are coming out of the military, they're just kind of done taking orders and want to just run their own show. And if it fails, it's on you. And yeah. if it succeeds, well, also on you. And so you're the master of your own destiny, I guess, or however that phrase goes, and you can control it. And so that's kind of a nice, like freeing feeling when you're able to take control of something and not have to rely on someone else dictating what it is that you do or not do or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, a key component to good therapy is focusing on what people can impact, mm-hmm. right? And so if you're the business owner, you can impact all of it, which is terrifying and great, right? Like all of a sudden you're not like getting payroll in, you're looking at whether payroll is going to go through, which is always super fun.
Sure.
But since then, it's been 10 years now, clinical practice, specialized in working with men, veterans, and first responders. I've also been an educator. I've been a professor for counseling. I just got done presenting at our state conference on masculine issues. And it's been a wonderful ride, man. I wouldn't do anything else. I'm really glad I found the work.
No, it's always good hearing from folks who have gotten out of the military. A lot of times you hear these horror stories of this transition, like they don't know what to do and they feel lost and they're just floating around hopeless and pointlessly and mm-hmm. they just don't know what to do. But it's great to hear, you know, somebody who has kind of figured out what it is that they want to do when they grow up.
I had a 10-year advantage on everybody else, right?
Sure.
So if, like, I was in my 30s by the time, hopefully I'd figured something out by then.
right. Well, you know, you did have that going for you, but, you know, there are still those people. I mean, they enlist when they're 18, they get out when they're, you know, in their late 30s, and then it's like, can't, oh, crap, I didn't even think of what's next, you know?
There's a reason why we make up a significant portion of the homeless population.
I mean, and I'm sure that's part of it. And, you know, I'm sure there's other issues too that go into it. But, you know, so with the work that you were doing while you were in the military, you know, especially around some of that fun stuff that you got to do, quote unquote, fun stuff that, you know, basically punching the guys in the mouth and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I know that's not exactly, that was more tongue in cheek, you know, the way you were mm-hmm. phrasing it, but, you know, it makes me kind of think about like kind of the definition of, you know, masculinity and how that has changed and evolved over the years, and where it may have seemed like a, you know, macho thing or, you know, masculine thing to be that dick, like you put it, like, you know, way back when, where now it's like, no, the guy who actually stands up for people who need the support and, you know, need that kind of help, like, no, that's kind of more the masculine side. And that's what we're looking for. And I think that's probably the lessons that you were trying to get across to the folks that you were teaching, right?
Well, so it was funny. The reason I make the joke about punching rapist is that it was very different training Air Force members and training college kids. Right.
Right.
So the Air Force guys were hard to convince to pay attention. Right. They're like, hey, man, I don't want trouble. I don't know what's going on. I don't know who she's here with.
Yeah.
Like, why should I care? And then you talk them around like, hey, man, if it was your sister, would you care? Like, wouldn't you want somebody to help you out if you were in a bad situation? We've all made mistakes. It's not their fault. And then like, okay, cool. I punch him. No, man, you can't punch him. You're going to go to jail.
Right.
So let's talk about what to do. Get on a college campus, talking to college kids about it. And that was an entirely flipped conversation for the most part. They're like, no, man, I'd love to help, but I'm not getting punched for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, hey, man, you don't have to get punched. It's okay.
There's
some things to do. And it's just like a lot of the military training, right? It's about knowing what to do in the crisis, and it changes things for people in drastic ways.
Yeah.
I think the masculinity question is, it's a really wonderful time for the conversation finally. So when people had been talking about masculinity in any kind of frame for the last 10 years, they've been doing it pretty poorly. It's either people saying that John Wayne is the only way to be a man.
Right.
Like, be John Wayne or you're not a man. And if we need to put women and everybody else back in their boxes to do that, then that's worth it. Like, that's what we should be doing. Or there is no gender. Masculinity is toxic. This isn't something we should be doing. And in the last year or two, we're starting to see guys like Scott Galloway, Richard Reeves, a number of other masculine people coming forward and talking about what guys need, how these things can be channeled well. Right. So I like Reeves's four traits of masculinity. Men tend to be more sexual. We tend to be more physically aggressive. We tend to be less risk adverse for physical danger. And we tend to be more status driven. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And they have been largely channeled in toxic ways. You know, we got the Andrew Tates of the world turning everybody into little automatons of just assholery. Right. But all of those also have positive channels. And by just acknowledging that they're in us, and that they're things, what I find is most guys really identify with two of those. And they're like, yeah, one of them, they're like, yeah, that's me too. Like, I grew up in this culture. And then one of the four just does not resonate with them at all.
Okay.
Right. So when I say a masculine trait, I mean it like, I like men are taller than women, right? Everybody gets that if I go to a WNBA reunion, I'm the short person at 6'1 in the room, right?
Right. Right. Exactly.
And what that also does is it leaves room for guys to recognize that they also tend to have feminine qualities, right? Won't be as, if you're a guy and you're identified as a guy, it won't be as many as the masculine traits, and that's great. But I'm a counselor. I talk about feelings all day. That's pretty feminine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just because I can throw a guy around and do all the other stupid things that I do for fun doesn't mean that that nurturing isn't in me.
Sure.
Right? And I think that as we have those conversations and we allow the bandwidth for people to look at themselves, look at their drives, look at what they want without shame, then they get to pick how they channel it and they get to have purpose with it. And that's where the beauty happens. That's when connection happens. That's when we feel connected to people and things based on our responses and what we have in us.
Sure.
It's a much better time in the world.
Yeah. And I think that's something that we're definitely lacking in the world, you know, connecting with each other. You know, as great as the internet is, I mean, this conversation right now wouldn't be happening if it wasn't for the internet, right? But it also disconnects us in a lot of ways. I mean, social media does allow connections to take place, but it also dehumanizes people because you're looking at a screen when you're reading those words or watching that video or whatever. And it's, you know, it's a screen. It's a device that's in your hand, and it's not a person sitting on the other side of the room that you're physically talking to. And that's not the right way to look at things either. So building those kind of connections, I think that's something I think we need some more of. And it probably goes to, you know, talking about some of the mental health issues that we have. If, you know, a lot of times folks end up isolating themselves, but they may be fooling themselves and saying, oh yeah, no, I'm connected to people. It's just, you know, through a screen.
I'm on a Discord. I got to talk to people every day.
Right, exactly. But it's not exactly the same, is it?
No. The way I like to frame social media out is social media is to connection as cotton candy is to food.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
If it's part of a meal and you're doing it and it's fun, that's fine. but you need to be around people who care about similar things to you.
Sure.
And whatever that is, it really doesn't matter what you build community around. But social friction matters for feeling safe socially. Like, I got to be able to look you in the face and know that, like, I might hurt you, you might hurt me, and we're choosing to spend this time together anyway.
Right, right. Yeah, there is that possibility, you know, and if I start mouthing off and being a dick, like...
Or just saying the wrong thing. I mean, like, sure. Emotional hurt, right?
Okay, yeah, no, that too, yeah.
Right? Like, I don't know about you, man, but I'm 45. I'm not throwing punches anymore, really.
Right. Yeah, I'm not too far off, and yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. So for my podcast, I talk a lot to guys, and at the end, we always talk about their masculinity. And of course, for most of the veterans, violence, that like that physical aggression is in there somewhere as part of their masculinity. And it got me thinking about like when the last time I was punched in the face was like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh man, I don't think I could, I think I'd get dropped now. I don't think I've got the, like this jaw is not tough anymore. I don't think I've gotten pretty soft.
Yeah. It's been a while. Probably part of my guy brain is like, no, man, you got this. Yeah. You could definitely handle it. You know, but in reality, probably not.
Brain's pretty dumb around it, right? Like,
right.
Ronda Rousey, back when she was undefeated and at the top of her field of beating people to near death, 60% of American men thought they could take her in a fight.
Yeah.
Which is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Like, any combat vet knows, right? If you're trained, that's more important than you, how big you are.
Right.
Right. Like, if it's not training, yeah, the bigger guy usually wins. Check.
Sure.
But training wins every time.
Right. Yeah. And she's got way more time for training than I ever will have. So, yeah. No, she'd whoop my ass.
100%.
Yeah. I mean, no argument there. Yeah. Right? I would just be like, you know what? You win. I walk away. You know.
Which just cracks me up. Think about that. 60% of U.S. guys. 6 out of 10 guys you meet in that moment and time thought, well, yeah, it's a woman. I could still take her.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of crazy. But, you know, it also might just be part of, like, I don't want to admit that I think a woman could beat me up. You know, that kind of mindset. And, you know, look, could I probably hold my own against most women? Yeah, probably. Not against her or people like her, you know?
Well, I imagine for you, you could probably hold your own against most people even, right?
Possibly.
Like, you're a big enough guy, you're competent enough. I'm a big enough guy, I'm competent enough.
Sure.
Where that comes from is that status tick that we have as guys.
Yeah, right.
So it's important to acknowledge it, because it gets a bad rap that guys are status driven, but it's kind of baked into us.
It is, yeah. And that's one of the four things that you mentioned too, is the status. And that's... It's just a thing we have, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a status, like, you know, you're a CEO or you're a, you know, whatever your job title is. It's, you know, the dominant in person in this situation, that could be a status as well. Winner, loser, that type of thing could be status too, right?
When it goes into what masculinity becomes over the lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're young, our masculinity is the privileges we show up with, right? Are you big? Are you charming? Are you athletic? Right? Where are you naturally capable? And that's what you trade on for masculine status. So women, because of the period, because there's a biological marker of when things change for them, most cultures have a understanding and tradition around, like, oh, this age, you're a woman now.
Yeah.
And everybody kind of accepts that. Men do not have that moment in time. So almost every culture up until very recently had traditions that said you went through some kind of test that you could possibly fail to become a man, which means masculine status has to be earned and it can be lost. And that's why we tend to respond to status loss like women respond to violence. It is more emotionally arduous for men to take a status hit. Doesn't excuse bad behavior around it. That's not what I'm saying.
Right.
But it's why we get so reactive.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I think part of that, like, so we identify with, you know, maybe whatever status is, or, you know, a lot of these other traits that you were talking about. But also, you know, through that military service, talking about, you know, veterans and stuff, you know, there's that transition period where you have this status of a service member, you know, whatever branch you are in, you know, that there's something, sense of purpose, sense of meaning that is tied to that. And then when you get out, you know, not everybody was like you and just kind of figured out what it was that they wanted to do, you know, relatively quickly. And they kind of lose that identity. And then they're sitting there scratching their head, thinking like, what the hell am I? You know, what do I do with myself now? Where's my sense of self-worth or purpose or meaning in life, really? And that's, I think, where some guys start to spiral and kind of get a little bit lost at that point, right?
It's incredibly jarring. So maybe you've heard this adage before about the male kid on the aircraft carrier talking to the president. So president's torn, an aircraft carrier, right? Floating city, comes across the lowest guy on the ship, who's the mail clerk.
Okay.
And he says, young man, what do you do on the ship? And he says, I got the most important job on the ship, sir. Oh yeah, tell me about that. Well, if I don't deliver this, we don't turn. If I don't deliver this, we don't eat. If I don't deliver this, the guns don't fire. I have the most important job on the ship, sir. The military is incredibly good at making everyone feel connected to the mission.
Yeah.
No matter how asinine the work, no matter how stupid the dumb games your commander making you play, it's good at convincing you that this is in service to something more important than you.
Mm-hmm.
And largely is, right? I don't think the military's blowing smoke when it's doing this.
Right.
It also, that sense of community, right? So I did intelligence work, man, which was always shift work. So I literally spent half of my life those years with the guys on set with me, with the same eight people for the most part, in weird hours at weird times. And you get very intimate just because of the proximity with each other. And guys that, like, we vote very differently, right? Mm-hmm. We don't share a lot of values. They still have space on my couch if they need it.
Yep.
Right? Those are my guys. And the military is really good at that because it's kind of a shared, it's a little bit like trauma bonding, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're all going through the same kind of crap together.
Sure.
And then for that masculine status, particularly since it's usually young guys that join, it's one of the only things that everyone agrees that once you've signed up in your uniform, you're a man now. It's one of the only universally accepted, like, okay, now you've got that masculine status, you're a right. man.
It's kind of like our era's test, if you will, like what you're saying, like generations before have had various tests, and this is kind of like one of those things. It's not for everybody, but it is one of those things that once when you've gone through that, you can say, yep, I'm a man, you know?
Well, and it's been, and that really works out for well for a lot of guys. Like I got two guys that are former special forces operators mm-hmm. who are now stay at home dads. Do you think their masculinity could take that hit if they had to done that other job being those guys?
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Probably have a harder time with it.
Probably.
For me being a guy who talks about feelings all day, if I didn't have the status of being a former uniform, it might be harder for me to do and not feel a way about.
Right. Right. Yeah. And so these guys get out and I'm saying guys, cause we're talking a lot about masculinity. And so mm-hmm. sorry to the ladies who might be listening to this, but this is kind of for the boys today, I think, you know, kind of this conversation.
For transition stuff, it's pretty, that's pretty unisex. It's the same problem.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But yeah. And I guess, you know, some of the other stuff too, like, you know, there's other mental health issues that might come from service in the military. It doesn't necessarily have to be combat trauma. You know, you were talking before about sexual assaults and things like that. And that there's a lot of stuff that can be universally applied regardless to whoever we're talking about.
It doesn't get talked about a lot, but one of the highest suicide rates for veterans coming out are non-combat deployed Marines.
Hmm.
And it's because they joined the Marines to be a rifleman and then they didn't get to be one.
Right.
And then they get out. And one of the other things that happens is a lot of times when we go in, most people, I would say, when they go in are a little lost.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For a lot of guys, if they're honest about it, they're like, yeah, it was the military or college, and college didn't make sense to me. So I don't know. I let the Army send me somewhere and oh, goody, here's where I got sent.
Right. Yep.
Right. It's an outlet to kick a decision down the road. Because once you're in the military and you're in uniform, you're no longer making decisions about your life. You're making decisions about how to handle your life. You go where you're told, you're with who you're told to be with.
Yeah.
You don't have to think real hard about those things. And so we get out 8, 10, 4 years later, we're behind our peers who have been making those decisions because we don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I feel like there's some, maybe some gaps in the current approaches to dealing with some of these things. Like, you know, some of the therapies that might be offered may not be, they might be good for certain things, certain mm-hmm. specific conditions, but I feel like there might be kind of like a bigger picture type of thing that we need to start looking into, because I don't know if it's always just a one thing that is, you know, causing someone to need some sort of therapy, and maybe that one type of therapy isn't appropriate. Maybe there needs to be something else, right?
What I notice with, and this is just a veteran thing, but it's also very much a guy thing. Mm-hmm. We don't go to therapy until everything's on fire.
Yeah.
And the last thing that's like really important to us is on fire, and we're like, fix this. And you're absolutely right. It's a whole life.
Yeah.
And the other thing that happens is the military, since it tends to pull in people that are lower socioeconomically in the background, they're people that show up with struggles. Mm-hmm. Like anybody who served has met the guy who came from absolutely nothing to the point where he didn't have hygiene. And right. the military had to spend thousands of dollars on dental for the guy because like of how he grew up. Mm-hmm. We all remember that guy, right?
Yep.
And that's one of the beautiful things about the military, is that it's a way out for some people. Mm-hmm. But that means they're going back into the civilian world to the same places with the same skill set of poverty. And the military absolutely doesn't teach money management. Just walk by a barracks and see how many Mustangs are in that. You know, like
30% interest or something right? stupid. Right?
Yeah, yeah. The other thing around the mental health care and the medical issues around it is the military's medical system is drastically different than what civilian life needs. And it has to be. I think military medicine gets a really bad rap, but at the end of the day, it does its job very well, which is get me back to my mission. Mm-hmm. I don't care about my long-term health. I don't care about the consequences. Get me back to the guys that need me.
Yeah.
Right? And in that environment, that makes sense. Right? I don't think I'd want to change that. Hmm. However, that means you're racking up a pretty big bill for when you get out.
Right. Right.
And we're bad at engaging medical systems because we're used to like, well, I'm not dying.
Right.
Like, I'm fine. It's yeah, fine.
And you don't want to be seen as the guy who's the slacker or whatever, who's mm-hmm. going to medical instead of doing whatever the job is, yeah. trying to skirt out of work or, you know, somehow get around doing it. And so you don't want to be that guy, so you just don't go. And mm-hmm. that just kicks the can down the road. And I think, you know, at our age, you know, both kind of mid-40s, You realize that catches up to you, and there's really no going back on some of that, right?
Well, some of it. What I will say is it's been interesting to me, right? My dad was in the trades, and he was a hard partying biker, right? Okay. So he had a lot of miles on him, is how he would put it. It's not the years, it's the miles.
Yep.
And I look like he looked in his early 30s right now, right? Mm-hmm. It's those miles, and it's that ability to engage in a system more broadly that helps us.
Yeah.
I think it was hilarious, right? So I'm organizing all these things for veterans coming out. I, as part of the orientation, it's, hey, what's hurt and who's helping you figure out where you're getting care and if you need disability. Mm-hmm. Like, how did the military break you? I didn't serve in combat and the military broke me. How did it break you? Right?
Yeah.
And I did that for a year. And finally, one of the guys I was helping, he's like, oh, well, so what's your stuff look like? Oh man, I don't need it. I'm good. I'm just helping you guys.
Right.
And he's like, what the, are you serious right now?
Yeah. And that's the way it goes, because again, the military is really good at placing the mission or something bigger than yourself, you know, ahead of your own needs. And so of course you're going to go out and you're going to help those other guys and do all those things and help them. Meanwhile, neglecting your own stuff and not taking care of it, even though you know damn well you should be, you're just not going to.
Yeah. Well, and some of it goes down to the thing with the military that's very good. And it's also just culturally masculine in America mm-hmm. is we don't value ourselves as much as we value everything else.
Yeah.
No, that's true. On our list of priorities, we're pretty towards the bottom.
Right. And I remember, you know, even myself, when I was joining the military, this was post 9/11, we were in Iraq, in Afghanistan. We're doing all those things. I joined as an infantryman. Basically, when I got off the bus at basic training, they said it's not a matter of if you get deployed, it's when you get deployed. You know, you're going to at some point. So, you know, that mindset was there that was like, hey, I'm here. I signed up to do this job. I know that it's a dangerous job. I know that bad things can happen. It's in the news all the time. Bad things are happening to, you know, these people who are being deployed. And it's like, all right, well, that's what the country needs, and that's what I'm going to do. That was the attitude that I had going in. Of course, you know, being younger than I am now and not having a family and all that kind of stuff, that kind of helped, yeah, you know.
It gets harder.
Yeah, and then you start adding those other responsibilities, and it's like, okay, well, you got to start prioritizing. Where are you really willing to make those kind of sacrifices?
Well, because all of a sudden, it's not just sacrificing you.
Right.
Right. And I don't think other clinicians would disagree, right? Everything needs to be self-motivated, but I don't think that's true. Everything needs to be connected,
mm-hmm.
right? Our motivations need to be in connection to people and things that are important to us to be any kind of happy.
Yeah.
And the main problem with that is when folks get out of the military is very good at filling all of those needs in one place with one thing, which makes a very sharp focus, but an incredibly brittle set.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause all it takes is something tapping it sideways and yeah. your family falls apart. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of MOSs where it's what a divorce a rank was the joke.
right?
Yeah. And so what happens is guys are used to just having that in their pocket, then they get out and they expect their work to do all that heavy lifting for them.
Mm-hmm.
And civilian work most of the time does not do that heavy lifting.
Right.
And nor should it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be really healthy outside of combat situations for that to be the focus of things. Nothing right. else should be that mission driven.
Right.
Right. And so that's where a lot of guys struggle. There was a stat a few years ago, and I don't know if it's still true or not, but the average length of employment for a veteran's first job was 6 months before they were either terminated or quit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they get into the job and they want it to feel like it did before. And it won't.
Right. It won't. Yeah. And I heard another one. I don't know if it's similar or related to the same study that you're talking about, but within the first 2 years after getting out, about 80% of veterans have already gone on to their next job. Mm-hmm. Again, whether they quit or were fired or whatever, like that's a crazy number. Like that 80%, like that's not like an insignificant amount. That's most people who,
yeah.
you know, within 2 years, and 2 years is not a lot of time to be working any kind of job. Now, of course, you may get out and it's like, I just don't know what I'm going to do, but I need to pay the bills. So I'm going to just find something to do, you know, basically anything just to get a paycheck right now. And then over time, you start to figure out what you want to do, and then you move on. I can understand that. And that could be where a lot of that comes from, but I don't know if it is. You know, it's...
So I think it's gotten a lot better since we were in. Like, mm-hmm. when did you get out?
2011.
Yeah, so we got out around the same time. It was 2012. And so now the programs for folks transitioning out are much more robust.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the guys getting out aren't in a place to pay attention yet.
Yeah, right.
Right. They're just like, all they know is that they're done with the military, and whether it's because they can't do it anymore because of an injury, whether they've served their term and it's time to do something else, or because the military was not a good experience for them, mm-hmm. and they're ready to go. That's the focus.
Yeah.
And thinking about the future while you're still in uniform is incredibly difficult.
Right. And a lot of times the information that they're giving to you, it's like you're drinking from a fire hose, because you just get so much information all at once that it's like, there's no way I'm going to remember all this stuff too.
Well, it's just like anything else in the military, right? Like, give them all the information that they could possibly need and expect them to know it. Go.
Right. Right.
Yeah. It doesn't work out long-term.
No, it doesn't. No.
I think that was my favorite part of working on the college campus, is there were plenty of guys who were not going to be college guys that came, but the GI Bill paid their bills for a minute. And they're on a campus where everyone there is trying to figure out what they want to do when they grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we also had one of the few offices where our retention rate wasn't as important.
Hmm.
So when you get onto a campus, every service there is designed to keep you on that campus until you graduate. Ours was just serving the veterans.
Okay.
Right. And what that meant is a guy might come in for a semester or two and then figure out this isn't for him. And then we turn him on the fact that some of the unions have it set up where when you go in for your journeyman, for your electrician, for the pipe fitter, that you get to use your GI Bill to pay your bills while you're not making any money as a journeyman, well, on your way up as an apprentice, right? We can turn them onto those programs. It was our jobs to help them find those programs. Mm-hmm. And so if you're getting out, even if you don't want to be a college person, find a university in your area that's got a robust and good veterans program and help, let them help you make that turn. Because otherwise you're going to do what I did, which was sit on a couch drunk day drinking for 6 months trying to figure it out.
Right.
And that's a crap way to do that. There's better ways, I promise.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, and you're probably not the most clear-headed as you're thinking about what it is that you want to do with your life as you're, you know, sitting on the couch day drinking. And in and of itself, that's not the best decision, you know.
No. Well, for me, I thought I really did enjoy doing the bystander training stuff. Yeah. Like, I had a lot of fun connecting with guys on that. It felt very purpose-driven. It felt very aligned. Like, I've been getting like different social justice awards since I was 20 years old. And so I felt like I found my thing. Like, I can talk to men about this. It's important for men for this. Let's go. Mm-hmm. But I got really burnt out doing the advocacy work. Because so when you're working a crisis line, you're literally talking to people on the worst day of their life every time someone calls.
Yeah.
And then you don't get to hear the end of the story. You hand them to the resource and you pick up the phone for the next person. Mm-hmm. And that repetition really burnt me out. And there just isn't a lot of justice in that world. The people like to rag on the military for it. The US justice system is not particularly better. It just has different problems than the military justice system around sexual assault. And so you don't see a lot of justice either.
You're right.
And yeah. So it took a while to figure out how to go about doing something different. And then I was like, well, wait, what if I could just help people figure out the story? So I still see guys in the worst month of their life. Mm-hmm. I just get to watch them turn it around.
Right. And I got to imagine that that would be difficult to only see just the worst part of it and never seeing the conclusion. It's almost like watching a movie and then stopping it like three quarters of the way through or halfway through or something and not knowing how any of that ends. It's almost like an itch you can't scratch, right?
Yeah, it's a lot like what happened to the drone guys, mm-hmm. right? So the uniformed drone guys got hosed where it needed to be a uniform firing the weapon. Mm-hmm. But it was contractors that would fly it around to get there. And so literally they might have a day where like four different occasions, they're watching up close feeds of what their button push is doing. Mm-hmm. And then they're being traumatized by that, but they feel like they aren't allowed to be traumatized by that because they're in an air conditioned building somewhere far away.
Right.
And it's that same kind of thing where if your whole day is horror, it's going to wear on you. It's going to cause problems at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that kind of job has to be pretty high turnover, I would imagine. You know,
so a lot of it has to do with whether it's trained well or not.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a distinct difference that happens in the brain when you have empathy instead of sympathy. Mm-hmm. So they took MRIs while they showed people stories. And when someone sympathizes, it's, oh my God, imagining me there. I really need to get you out of this situation. You poor person. I'm now invested mm-hmm. in needing to get this out. That puts them into a fight or flight space.
Okay.
Like emotionally and in brain chemistry. If it's empathy of, I see you suffering. I'm so sorry that's happening to you. I'm here. It releases pleasure hormones. It releases connection hormones. And so a lot of the training for you new counselors is making sure that you know how to regulate and accept the systems that exist to be in empathy instead of sympathy, okay. Or you will burn out. You cannot be in human services and constantly be in sympathy, trying to fix everybody's problem for them. It doesn't work.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. Yeah. I get that. And you know, we were talking a little bit before about, you know, kind of connection, and I don't know if we necessarily talk communities, but, you know, like not isolating, getting involved with something in a group or, you know, other folks with similar interests, whether it's an activity that you're doing or some other hobby or it's, you know, could be a veteran group like a VFW or American Legion, that those types of things or whatever, but being involved with somebody somewhere at some point, I think is probably one of the bigger things that folks can do to help themselves when it comes to their mental health I mean, I'm sure there's other things that they can do as well, but having that community, that connection, kind of what you were talking about before, gives you somebody else that you can, like, hey, I need to be there for that person, or, you know, that person might need me, so I'm going to be there for them, and I'm going to show up for those people. You know, yeah, sure, your family could be that group as well, but I feel like there's probably something outside of that as well that for many people anyways might be the thing that they're missing, maybe. I don't know if that's
the thing that almost every American's missing right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think for veterans it's harder because we had it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most 19-year-olds don't. Half of guys under 25 can't name a best friend.
Hmm.
And so that the comment about, well, family's probably good, but it's not enough,
right,
is 100% accurate.
Yeah.
That no point in human history were we ever designed to be in a singular, like, household, right? If you look at how this meat sack is wired, it's wired to be on the plains doing hunter-gatherer stuff, which means I'm supposed to be in a group of 20 people that are entirely interdependent on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And my system is regulated for that. The things that trigger the pleasure and purpose and everything in me are wired for that. And now you and I are talking on a screen and are likely never to meet in person.
Right. Yeah, no, and that's true. And I've had hundreds of conversations with people that I have never met in person. And it's all been through, you know, virtual talks like this. And, you know, folks who tune into this and they either listen or watch this interaction, they likely will never bump into either of us either. And, you know, and so they may have listened to many episodes of, you know, your podcast, my podcast, whoever, and they may feel like they start to know the person a little bit because they've heard them talk and heard some of their stories and got to know a little bit about their background and who they are. Mm. But it's different than being in the same room or in the same place, where whatever the location happens to be, and actually having real conversation with them, making actual eye contact. I mean, I'm looking at a camera right now. I mean, you're on the screen, but you're kind of like off on the side. I'm looking at a camera. And so, you know, I got like one beady eye looking at me with a blue light next to it. And like, yeah. It's not really the same thing, right?
No. And it's funny because like, I always feel hypocritical because at this point in my practice, I'm only doing telehealth. I don't have an in-person office anymore.
Sure.
But my big push for my colleagues when I do education events is our job as clinicians is individual. We're there to help get people the things they need and the tools they need to build the connected life.
Mm-hmm.
But we shouldn't be the connected life as a clinician. We're not supposed to be. The only way we can do the job is if there's some distance there.
Yeah.
And everybody's struggling with this. This isn't a veteran issue, man. People are having a really hard time. And it's because in the 50s, we came up with this idea that the nuclear family had to be the centerpiece of every world. And it largely isn't. Like, your family is your family, and they're incredibly important. And if you don't have family, or you've been in a space where you don't have family, you know how painful that is.
Mm-hmm.
But your family can't be an island. Nothing good happens. And so there's kind of two different kinds of connection, right? There's intimate connection where like you and I are friends. I'm one of the people that you can come to and talk about when you screw up. Like, man, I'm really ashamed of this. I did a bad thing.
Sure.
And that intimacy means that you can come talk to me about it. It doesn't mean I'm going to be happy with you, but we're close enough that you'll talk to me about it.
Sure.
Then there's community connection, which I think the military is a fantastic example of. Everybody there is doing something that matters to you. All the people doing that with you matter to you. And there are a lot of them you don't like. Like 1 in 10 people you meet in the world, you're not going to like.
Mm-hmm.
And that counts. And so community is just, I'm around people doing something similar that care about a similar thing. I don't have to like everybody here. I just have to show up to do the thing. And it doesn't matter whether that's pickleball, doesn't matter if it's a soup kitchen, doesn't matter if it's a VFW. It just means people will notice if I'm not here.
Right.
And that matters.
Yeah, it does. And I think that could go a long way when it comes to that mental health, you know, the issues that we are having. And you're right. I don't think it's necessarily just a uniquely veteran issue. I think it kind of applies to all of society. And got to imagine, you know, a few years ago, COVID probably didn't help all of that when everybody was just kind of isolating away from everybody.
They basically supercharged it and we're still struggling with it. So like I'm a big geek, right? I like Dungeons and Dragons and the like, and my whole role within my friend group was wrangling the nerds, right? Like I'm the social one. So I would get everybody together to play the stupid games together. Now my introverted nerds won't be wrangled. Mm-hmm. They're like, we'll go get dinner, man. But it's too much to be around more than like one other person.
Yeah. And so I think we maybe as a society have just gotten our tolerance for people has been lowered, you know, the groups of people, like even amongst friends, like you're saying, it's just reduced and we've like, well, we manage without them for a period of time. And I guess I can still do that. And, you know, I think we've managed to, you know, it's kind of like I can get by, you know, I'm a little short on cash, but I can get by with, just being a little cheap here and there, and you know, I can get by, but it's not going to be as good as it could have been if I was, you know, had my pockets full of cash. Same idea with the friends. Like we've gotten by without them for a little bit. So do we really need them, you know, that much anyways?
And then the trepidation of the social friction, right? So machines remove social friction. And they've done all kinds of different studies on it. But one of the ones that's the most interesting to me is they go into big companies and they turn off their email in a division for a week to see what happens. Productivity goes up.
Interesting.
And it's because middle managers have panic attacks about clearing their inboxes. I'm not exaggerating that. I work with those guys.
Yeah,
it's terrible. There's just this constant flood of things that they're supposed to be organizing and it never stops. And so they literally have 10 seconds to pick where this task goes in their team versus having to get up, walk to the other cubicle and look at the guy in the face and say, hey, I need you to do this. Where all of a sudden he has to think and get a response for the request. And lo and behold, tasks get organized better when you have to do that.
Interesting.
But yeah, it's also nerve wracking, right?
It is.
Because then that middle manager is like, oh man, he's going to be pissed when I ask him to do this.
Yeah. But to that point, you're going to start thinking a little bit more about who you're assigning those tasks to. And if you've always been given all the tasks to Bill and Bill's getting overloaded and he's burning out and he's, you know, just because it's easier just to fire off the email to Bill and, you know, just send it and you're not even really thinking about it. But if you've gone over to Bill's desk 10 times in the last, you know, 6 hours and, you know, keep dropping stuff on his desk, you're going to be like, you know what, maybe I should give it to somebody else and give Bill a break a little bit here, right?
Well, and it gives Bill a chance to advocate for himself.
Sure.
Where in an email, like I reply to an email, that doesn't feel like much.
Right. That's true.
And so the big thing that I find is that the guys that are living in isolation, they've lived there so long that the social friction is painful. Like for them to go back into the world and go back into community is painful.
Yeah.
And so they come up with all these excuses of like, oh, those people aren't for me. Oh, they won't like me because of this. Yeah, some of them won't. You are absolutely correct. And you won't like some of them. That is 100% correct. In fact, there are hobbies that you can have that you won't want to talk to any of those people about anything but the hobby and still have a great time.
Sure.
Right? But you need to get out there and feel what that's like again and build up some tolerance, build up some resistance to it. I had the guys from Next Level University on my podcast to talk about motivation and like, cause they're super amped, right? Their whole thing is like getting top performers to be better performers. They're ridiculous. And the whole episode series about grit, building up grit to do the things you need to do. And to follow up with that, I realized that we never talked about tolerating rejection.
Okay.
If there's something you want in the world and you don't have it, odds are you're going to have to deal with other people to get it, which means you're going to have to deal with people rejecting your requests. And that hurts. Like being rejected on any level is not comfortable or good.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. But and if you don't ask, the answer is always going to be no. Right.
100%. But to get comfortable asking, you got to ask for the smaller things first. You got to do some things to take care of yourself. And so that's the other thing is all of a sudden with veterans come to like bring it back around to the guys getting out. They're used to the military and everybody taking care of them while they do the mission. And now they have to figure out how to take care of themselves and participate in the family's care, which is a big transition and really hard to do because you're going to suck at it.
Yeah.
right? Like if you've never done kid drop-off because you were often deployed, you don't know all the foibles and all the BS that happens at kid drop-off.
Right.
And that's going to be really uncomfortable. But the only way to get comfortable at something is by being uncomfortable in it for a little while.
Yeah, and I think we've all experienced that to some extent if we've served in the military. I mean, I don't know anyone who was like, you know, I was totally comfortable in my training, my basic training or whatever. Well, I don't know, maybe Air Force. I don't know. I'm just
kidding. It's camp, man. It's okay. Yeah, right.
You guys are out there playing Frisbee. And but no, it's, I mean, all joking aside, you know, even the Air Force, I'm sure it wasn't, you know, a cakewalk every day, you know, and I'm sure you had some struggle going through some of that and it was uncomfortable, but it transformed you into who you became as far as your military career, right?
Well, my basic story was really interesting. So I finished up my bachelor's studying sociology because no one told me that's a terrible degree to get. And my last paper I did was on how basic training works.
Okay.
Right? Like how do they break people and rebuild them? And then I go into basic and there's another college educated guy that's about my age. He's a guard guy. And he is having an incredibly hard time through basic and making everybody's life hard because he's not getting on board with the program. Right. Everybody usually has one in every unit where there's just some guy that can't get their head wrapped around it. Mm-hmm. And he was just, it was his ego. He was like, I'm older, I'm educated. This is stupid. And it was a wonderful thing to watch because it let me choose to join.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. No, I know exactly what they're doing. And I can still experience it and learn what I need to learn here.
Gotcha.
I can still have all the stress disruption. I can still gain the skills that basic training is supposed to be getting me to go be an airman. And so his example was really useful because I'm sure I would have struggled with that otherwise if he hadn't made it so miserable in that struggle.
Well, right. And it was kind of a blessing in a way because you were able to see it suck for somebody else. And you're like, well, shit, I don't want that for me.
Yeah, yeah. Look at that. They made a really good lesson out of that guy.
Right. Exactly. You know, thanks so much, dude.
Yeah. You stay on that struggle bus. I'm not getting on.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'll watch from afar and, you know, yeah, there's probably some group suffering that took place, I'm sure, in some cases, but.
Well, and kind of coming back around to the veterans transitioning out, right? The same thing happens when you get out.
Yeah.
And so that's why being around other vets that are further ahead than you matters, getting a little bit of mentorship, talking to people to normalize just how crap this feels sometimes mm-hmm. and how good it feels sometimes and how weird that both of those might be happening at the same time on the same couch, right?
Yeah.
Getting around guys who have been there that can like help you avoid some mistakes, validate some of the struggles, and give you some room.
Mm-hmm.
If you go through it by yourself, you know, you can probably do it, right? You're a competent guy. If you're listening, you're trying to get better. You're listening to this, but why?
Yeah.
Why hurt yourself?
Right. Yeah. I mean, so many people have gone through the same situation that you're in. And if you can learn something from them, so you don't make the same mistakes and waste your time doing those things that they had already done and they prove that they don't work. And so it's like, well, shit, just like, don't do that. Like, let's mm-hmm. find some other way to...
Hey, man, I get you don't have anything to do at noon, but maybe don't day drink.
Right.
Maybe that's not going to help as much as you think.
Yeah. You know, maybe putting together your resume, that might be a little more productive use of your time or, you know, looking for the jobs or whatever the case may be, you know, applying to schools or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, sometimes you almost need to have someone just kick your ass in the right direction and get you on track.
That's what I do miss about the veterans office, man. Like I eat worse. I work out less. They're super nice, right? They're great. I love my peers and my colleagues, but when I go get a bacon cheeseburger and eat at the desk, no one pats me on the belly and asks me how it is.
Right.
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 like I miss those guys like a little bit, like
they're a little too nice, I suppose. Yeah, so, the folks that you're with now, you know?
Yeah. Being around that community also normalizes it. Like, what are some of the questions you think some of those guys have that I can get? Because I'm feeling a little scattered on it right now.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things I think that folks are missing is like, I know from the conversations that I've had, you know, the experiences that I've had myself and experiences that other folks have had, you often do understand that, hey, there's a problem here with something, you know, whether it's a transition and not knowing what you're going to do with your life or mental health issues or, you know, all sorts of things, eventually you recognize, hey, there's a problem. But a lot of times the ego gets in the way and it's like, you know what, I'll be fine. I'll figure this out. Not a big deal. And until, like you said, until everything is like on fire and it's out of control, that's when you're like, oh, geez, I guess I should go talk to somebody and get some help, right? But a lot of times, I think it's kind of, I don't know if it's the right way to say is a fear of the unknown, but just not knowing what to do. You know, there's options, there's things out there, but it's the unknown unknowns, I guess, maybe is a better way to put it. It's like, I just don't know what to do, or, you know, what's that first step? What do I do when I'm stuck, when I'm feeling like I just don't know what to do next?
So one, if you're newly out, you can still go to a base. And every base has the family center. Mm-hmm. And part of that center is going to be a transition assistance. And all that fire hose that you were getting while you were just trying to out-process that you didn't catch, there's someone there that knows it, mm-hmm. that if you show up and ask questions to, they'll answer it. And that's a resource that's going to be available to you. Yeah. If that isn't available to you, most good VFWs got a guy, right? Mm-hmm. Most American Legions got a guy or gal. And not every university has a good veterans program. So if you're shopping around for a university, call their veterans program. Don't just apply for whatever school. See how it feels. Ask them how the process goes. And if they just sound overwhelmed and busy, try another school.
Yeah.
Right. But the big thing is those are three distinct options that you can have to not be alone with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that you don't have to know everything.
Right.
The big thing that a colleague told me, we used to do like a men's group where I got together with a few other dude clinicians because we're a little different, right? And I like how he described the work. He was like, I think our whole job is convincing guys they don't have to hold it together all the time, but they've got to hold it together most of the time.
Yeah.
And so the problem is when you hold it all the time, you don't pick when you drop it.
Okay.
You don't pick when you need a hand. You don't pick the thing that there's a hand for. You blow up your marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You hurt your family. You hurt yourself. Whereas if you just decide, like, I can be part of a community, I can show up, I can let these things and these people give me information to give me some guidance. Lo and behold, life's still really hard.
Yeah.
But now you put it down for a second and let somebody help you, so you're more likely to hold on well longer.
Sure, sure.
That's the whole game.
And, you know, I think those three resources that you just mentioned, and I'll put this in the show notes too for folks too who are, you know, maybe a little scatterbrained as they're listening to this and maybe didn't quite remember everything. But, you know, those three resources I think are good because most people I think can remember three things, and those are the things that will get you the help. It may not be necessarily the help that you need, but they'll be able to almost be like the traffic cop and like point you in the right direction and get you to where you need to go, or almost like maybe even another example, like a general contractor where he's the general contractor is now going to say, okay, well, we're going to need the electrician, the plumber, we're going to need the roofer, we're going to need all those people. And that's what we're going to need to finish this job. And so they go and get those people together and they put them together and they do whatever work they need to do to finish the job. You know, that person can direct you to the right resources, to the things that are unique and specific to you and the issues that you're going through. You may not know everything, but I guess the point is you don't have to.
You'll just feel better moving.
Yeah.
Right? Like we feel better in motion. Mm-hmm. If we got a problem and we're moving, we're at least doing something.
Right.
Even if that doesn't end up being fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you go to a VFW and they're just one of those beer and chili VFWs, which is nice. Sometimes you need a beer and some chili. I'm not ragging on them, but not all of them are doing community service.
Right.
Right? So maybe you got to go to a different one. But those guys usually know where the ones that are doing that stuff is.
Sure. Yeah. And the community's tight enough that, you know, people talk and you can find out that information.
Yeah. I think the other thing that I would tell anybody getting out is give yourself a little grace that you don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think we always want to be the guy that knows. Like, I know what happens next. I know who I am. I know where I'm going. You probably don't right now.
Yeah, right.
And that's incredibly normal. If you did, you're wrong. I promise you're wrong. There's going to be some stuff that happens out of that uniform that you're going to take in, and you're going to be like, wait, I don't, that was what the Marines needed from me, and I was happy to give it, but I don't need to do that now.
Right.
Oh man, airmen do this. That's really lame. Why would I do that way? Yeah, whatever right. It is, there's going to be something.
Yeah. I mean, look, just as a kind of an example, I've had, this is going to be episode 542 of this show. I've had conversations with literally hundreds of people who've either represented a resource, a nonprofit, or some other organization, or have used resources themselves, and they came on the show and they were talking about it, and they were doing something, you know, with themselves. And I guarantee you, I don't know everything either. I'm not even close.
We're not supposed to, right? We're supposed to know the guy. I need to know the guy.
Right. Exactly.
And you know, I get to be the guy about my thing.
Yeah. Right. And. I can't even confidently say that I know all the guys to point people to. I know a lot of them, but not everyone. And so, like, if you're just dipping your toes into this situation, you're like, oh, I'm supposed to know everything. No, you're not. You know, you're supposed to know, like, a couple people who can help point you in that direction and literally be the traffic cop and guide you in the right direction.
At least being open to meeting them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's great advice, honestly, you know, boiling it down to just a few resources that people can keep in the back of their head and use those resources when things are getting a little heavy for them and they can't carry it all on their own. I think that's, you know, as far as a takeaway goes, I think that's as good as they get.
There we go, man.
So before we wrap up, anything that you want to add or any resources or anything that you want to share with folks that you know, where they can, you know, maybe find some information about what you do or anything like that?
Absolutely. So after 10 years of clinical practice working with guys and the conversation shifting around masculinity, I started a podcast called American Masculinity. Don't ask me how I got that. I can't believe it wasn't taken. But if you're tired of the conversation either being people screaming about it having to be like John Wayne, or people telling you that you're toxic because you're aggressive, come and listen. I'm having great experts on. We're having deep conversations around the different aspects and different things that are going on in this country around men and boys and what they need and how we can grow. And it's, for me, it's been incredibly eye-opening. I've been surprised at who showed up. I've been really lucky. I didn't expect so many people to show up so soon that were coming from places of knowledge. But people are hungry for these conversations. People are worried about their sons. People are worried about what's going on with guys who aren't stinking rich. If you're a stinking rich white guy, life's still pretty good for you. For the rest of us, there's some things going on that we could probably be talking about and doing a little bit better on. And we can do it without lessening the things that other people need.
Yeah. Yeah. And help each other out. I think that's,
yeah, that's it.
Kind of the name of the game. So yeah,
be a good neighbor, right?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Well, I want to, you know, thank you for coming on, and I will link to your show and all that stuff in the show notes as well. But I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about this. I think it's one of those things that some people just kind of tiptoe around, and you know, I wanted to address it, you know, kind of openly and just have a conversation about it. And you know, there's some stuff that you kind of opened my eyes to, and I think, you know, maybe some of the listeners as well. And you know, I think we're, you know, as long as we keep talking and conversing with folks and helping each other out, I think we'll be moving in the right direction. So I do appreciate you coming on and sharing all these resources.
Thanks for doing for what you do, man. 500 episodes, you've helped a lot of people.
I hope so. All right, thanks again.